Writer and teacher Parker Palmer's book, On the Brink of Everything, isn't just about aging, but living.
I think in some ways I was always looking for models, role models of how to grow old in a healthy manner, and I feel lucky that I was able to find some.
Plus, we speak to a Purdue researcher about the work they're doing on warming in the Great Lakes. Although it might make for better swimming, higher temperatures could have a disastrous effect on Lake Michigan's game fish, like trout and salmon, which depend on cold water. That's all coming up on this special Encore edition of The 21st. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to this special Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Parker Palmer writes about many of the big things in life, from our vocations to civic discourse. He's a community organizer and founder of the Center for Courage and Renewal. At the heart of everything, though, he's an educator, and his latest book is meant to teach us a different way about how we think about aging. The collection of essays is called On the Brink of Everything: Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. This summer, we caught up with Parker Palmer from his home in Madison, Wisconsin. Parker, welcome to The 21st.
Well, thank you, Nyla, so much. It's good to be back home. I grew up, I was born in Chicago and then grew up in the Chicago suburbs, and my sisters still live down there, so I think I have decent Illinois credentials.
Yeah, we'll forgive you for moving to Madison. I think that's okay.
Thank you.
A 100-year-old told you that you were too young to write this book. Do you feel like you're too young to write a book about aging?
I'm glad you picked up on that. Yes, I had this wonderful, wonderful friend in Madison named Lois Boyer, and I had the privilege last November, I think it was, of attending her 100th birthday party. I never attended a 100th birthday party, and she was just full of spit and vinegar and just as alive and vital, and my wife and I got there first and greeted her, and she said, "Parker, what are you doing these days?" She had been a follower of my Facebook page and chimed in occasionally. And I said, "Well, I'm writing a book." "Well, what's it about?" "It's about growing old." And she said, "Parker, you're not old enough to write a book like that." And so I tell this story in the beginning of the book. And sadly, on the very day I was out at my publisher's place in Oakland, California, Lois died, and so I was able to tell that part of the story too, but fortunately I had given her kids a typescript of the story at the front of the book for Christmas, and she was delighted with it, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah, that's a lovely story. I think people often think, when you're thinking about getting old, oh, I'll get to that in another decade. Like in our 20s, we think this is what our 30s is going to look like. What did you think getting old was going to look like?
Well, I guess the first thing I have to say is I'm one of those maybe strange people. I don't know. For some reason, death has been on my mind since I was in my late teens or certainly my early 20s. I remember at the time I've been something of a student of the spiritual traditions, and I was reading a book called The Rule of Benedict, which is a pretty famous book in some circles, written by Saint Benedict in the 4th century or so as a rule for the monks who lived in the monasteries and preserved the literature and took in needy strangers and all kinds of good things. And one of his rules for the monks was daily keep death before your eyes. And when I first read it, I remember thinking, well, that's a tad morbid. I'm not sure I want to go that route. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that if you did that, your experience of life would be enhanced. You'd feel gratitude more deeply for life itself and all the gifts that life has to offer, as well as being reminded of the shadow side of life. So it's a little hard for me to say what I thought growing old would be like when I was younger. I was always drawn to older people. I had many older mentors. I had a grandfather whom I adored. I think in some ways I was always looking for models, role models of how to grow old in a healthy manner, and I feel lucky that I was able to find some. But at the same time, I also think that when you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, death is kind of hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine a world in which you don't exist because the old ego insists that can't be. And when I got into my 70s and started facing into it more realistically, that's when I started writing about it as a way of trying to find out more of how I imagined dying and how I felt about it.
And you wrote to that point about this mindset of keeping death daily before one's eyes. You wrote about this. You wrote that aging and dying well takes practice. So how do you think about that? How, I think people listening might think, oh, how do I do that?
Yes, of course. It's sort of an odd thing to say. But I think that, and I'm not far and away not the first person to say this, I think that life brings what some folks have called little deaths all the time. So there's the death of a dream, the death of a hope, the death of a vocation, the death of a relationship. And we can practice death by facing fully into the darkness of those moments, the challenge of those moments, not trying to walk around them or fly above them or numb our emotions to them. We can consciously attempt, I think, to bring them in more fully, to inhabit those little deaths. And I think, I deeply believe in something that I call keeping your heart supple, because life brings a lot of heartbreak with it, as we all know. Personal heartbreak, vocational heartbreak, political heartbreaks, so forth. And I've thought a lot about the fact that there are two ways for the heart to break. We can talk more about this later if you want, but it can shatter into a million shards and never quite get put back together, break apart that way, or it can break open into largeness. And I think by keeping the heart supple, by exercising it around the little deaths of our lives, we are making our hearts more supple, the way a runner exercises a muscle so it won't snap. In that way, I think we're practicing death at a certain level. And of course, it's not the full Monty, as you might say. It's not the last moment. But certainly some of those little deaths can feel like life will never be worth living again. And yet we can find our way through with a supple heart.
My guest is Parker Palmer. His most recent book is called On the Brink of Everything, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. And you mentioned the heart, and I actually wanted to ask you about our minds, because you wrote about the fact that I think sometimes our heartbreak comes from our mental expectations, our intellectual expectations of what we think our lives will be. And it was fascinating to me that you were writing about the question and posing the idea that asking ourselves, does our life have meaning, is actually not really even the right question to ask ourselves.
Well, I've been encouraged to, I love to study the roots of words. And if you go way back with the word heart into its deepest linguistic rootage, what you find is that it relates to the Latin word cor, C-O-R, which points to the core, C-O-R-E, as we would say, of our being. And in that core place, all of our faculties converge. So it's not only the heart back in the day was not only the seat of emotion, which is how we sort of understand it today, a rather narrowed version of heart, but it was the place where all of our faculties converge: emotion, thinking, intuition, visioning, you know, knowledge sources of various sorts. And one of my very favorite phrases from the spiritual literature, it comes from a Russian Orthodox teacher of many years ago who said, we need to learn to think with our minds descended into our hearts. And to me, that immediately suggested that we need to get the mind out of the tower, the cranium, and bring it down into that core place where it can collaborate with these other modes of knowing. And the core place is also the place where we're connected with other people. So it seems to me that thinking from that heart place gives us a doorway into a deeper understanding of both life and death. When I understand my connectedness with everything, with you, with your listeners, with a world that's suffering a great deal right now, with the natural world, et cetera, when I don't think of myself from the top of the tower as sort of that around which the sun revolves, but I rather understand that I am a very small piece of this much larger thing called life, and that even my death will contribute to life. I mean, that's the cycle of nature, right? The cycle of the seasons is all about things dying so that things can live. And I fully understand that it's a lot easier to accept that about plant life than it is about human life. And I'm not in any way trying to be glib about the losses we suffer on the human level from losing the dearest person in our life. But again, I think I've seen so many people who have in fact lost that dearest person and who go into a period of feeling that life will never be worth living again, and who slowly emerge into realizing that not in spite of that loss, but because of that loss, they have become, their hearts have been enlarged, made more open. They're more generous. They're more compassionate. They're more understanding. They're more connected. They're more willing to reach out to help and to ask for help. And it's in that kind of connectedness, I think, that we start to understand who we are in the ecosystem of life. And like any ecosystem, death has its role to play, not just as the end of the road, but as the compost for new life. While that's not an easy belief to hold, the more I reflect on it, the more I live into it as I approach age 80, the more I understand its meaning, and the less urgent this question, what is the meaning of my life, becomes. And I'm more interested in the question of what is the meaning of our lives. And I think one of those meanings is we're all in this together. And we need to, you know, live and die for the sake of one another.
To that point about connectedness and being together, you write a lot about intergenerational connections. And you said that young, particularly young and old people connecting are like joining the poles of a battery. Why did you say that?
Well, I guess, Nyla, I say it because it's my experience. I've been privileged in my life as a teacher on various levels and as a person who has intentionally gathered, especially in the last couple of decades, with people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. I've been very lucky to have frequent opportunities to reach out to the young, just as in my youth, older mentors reached out to me. And I frankly think that back in the day, when I was in my teens, 20s, and 30s, there were more elders who were willing and able to reach out to folks than perhaps there are today. So it's been my constant experience with those young people that they bring me new life. One of the first ways I might talk about that is, or make that concrete, is to say that they bring me news of the emerging world. And there is a new world emerging, culturally, socially, politically, that might be scary to me when I'm, you know, unable to see the horizon that's coming at us and it's all unknown. But when young people bring me news of the new world, not only through their words, but through their actions, I find myself more at home on the face of the earth and more at home in my own skin. Let me give you a couple of examples that always come to me. There are a lot of people my age who are scared about the fact that by 2045 or 2050, this country's population will be a majority people of color. I'm white, I'm male, I'm straight, I'm middle class, and I'm almost 80, or I'm nearing 80. And I know a lot of people of that description who are frightened by this diversity that will soon have us, people like me, in the minority. But one of the first things I noticed about my young friends is that they walk across so-called lines of difference without even noticing they're there. White people have friends who are of color. Straight people have friends in the LGBTQ plus community. Young people from different countries form friendship with each other. Among other things, they travel abroad more often than they did, than we did in my generation. So by watching the ease with which these young people walk across lines that ultimately really aren't there, we sort of make them up in our minds. I mean, I hope everybody knows that race is not given in nature. It's a social construct. I found clues to how I could feel, you know, more at home on the face of this very, very diverse earth.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Parker Palmer. His latest book that we're talking about is called On the Brink of Everything: Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Parker Palmer. His most recent book is called On the Brink of Everything: Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. We've been talking about that and more. He's on the line from his home in Madison, Wisconsin. Parker, you were just talking about politics. And first I have to ask, do you really have a t-shirt that says One Mean Quaker?
I really do. Somebody gave it to me. A friend gave it to me.
And you write about this, about the whole idea of being angry and how it's very easy in America 2018 to be kind of fixated on that anger.
Right. And I want to say a word about one of the seven sections of the book, which is called Keep Reaching Out. And it has essays in it that are political, and they're also confessional on my part, because I think white people need to be aware of all kinds of things in themselves, like white privilege and white supremacy. And one of the reasons I do that is that I see a lot of older people withdrawing from the fray and kind of hunkering down, partly because they're not connected with a younger generation that has a lot to teach us, I think, about how to walk into these times with some kind of hope and vision for this new world we need. And I'm especially eager to convey this message about keep reaching out, stay involved, because by definition, we older folks have a lot of experience. We have the benefit of living through a lot of edifying history that this country and its citizens dare not forget. I mean, just to tick off my own personal list, that the history I've lived through includes World War II. I was very young at the time, but I still have memories of the Holocaust, Japanese internment camps, wars in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, Senator Joe McCarthy and his fascism, Watergate, the civil rights movement, rising wealth and income disparities, the new Jim Crow, et cetera, et cetera. With all that experience of political pathologies, whose roots, incidentally, are bipartisan, I feel like I'd be irresponsible not to speak up about what's happening today. And so that's what I try to do in this book. Whatever one's political views may be, I want to encourage elders to bring their experience to bear and speak up and not forget the vital role they have to play among what this country has called we the people. Now, you specifically asked about anger, and I do have an essay there called What's an Angry Quaker to Do? And there's a little bit of ribbing myself going on there, because Quakers, not everybody knows much about Quakers, but Quakers are one of the so-called peace churches, along with Mennonites and the Amish, although Quakers live a fully engaged life, unlike the Amish, for example, engaged in the secular world. Most of my work has been in the secular world. We're supposed to be a peace-loving people, and there are folks who think that anger has no role in a peace-loving life. I think it would be subhuman to not be angry at some of the things that are going on today. I'm very, very angry about what's happening to the brown-skinned children on the border, being separated from their parents and done what many child psychologists say is permanent damage, to say nothing about the grief and anguish of all of those parents, for really no good reason except the failure of adults to take responsibility and figure out a rational solution to a problem that should never have happened in the first place. It's cruel and inhuman, and not to be angry about that, I think, makes me less than human. The question is not, is it okay to be angry? Of course it is, because there are things worth being angry about. The question is, how do you hold your anger? Do you become a bomb thrower or a mass shooter? Or do you start to figure out that anger is an energy that can be harnessed to either good or evil? And I've worked very hard at asking myself, how can I harness the energy of anger to good ends? And I have a variety of personal answers to that. For example, back in 2011, I published a book called Healing the Heart of Democracy, which has gotten me involved in a lot of efforts to talk across the lines that divide us. Again, partly inspired by those young people that I mentioned earlier. And so I'm continuing my engagement with that whole question of how to have civil conversation across the lines that divide us. And incidentally, civil conversation to me does not just mean watching our tongues or some simple-minded notion of tolerance. You know, I've somehow never found it especially reassuring when someone looks at me and says, I'm willing to tolerate you. I don't think that's a particularly good way to be in the world. I think the root of civil discourse is to value our differences and to realize that if we have a chance to hear each other's stories, we will come to deeper understanding of each other. We may not agree on everything or much, but we can at least create a relational container that allows the conversation to carry forward. And I think most people are aware that today we don't have many of those relational containers. People will say, even in their own families, I can't talk to my uncle, my aunt, sometimes my partner or spouse, let alone my friends, about some of my beliefs for fear that everything will blow up. So I'm fond of saying it's more important to be in right relationship than it is to be right. And that's what I mean by civil discourse. These are complicated questions in some instances, these political, social, economic questions. And we'll never get anywhere with complicated questions if we don't have strong containers that can hold an ongoing dialogue of differences. One of the big points I make in Healing the Heart of Democracy, which I at least touch on in this new book, On the Brink of Everything, is that this country was, as far as I know, the first country founded on the notion that conflict is not the enemy of a good social order. Conflict, rightly held, is the engine of a good social order. The whole of our Constitution is really meant to create institutions that hold conflict as an energy. But that begins with citizens, and it begins with me knowing how to hold my anger in a way that animates positive action rather than bomb throwing.
Parker, I wonder how much of this is about how we view conflict. And there is a political correctness, and also, as you write, a spiritual correctness about thinking that conflict is inherently not good. And I wonder if part of it is about reframing that and how we can go about doing that.
Yeah, I think that's a very perceptive question, Nyla. And we absolutely must reframe it, because when conflict is regarded as that which shall not be mentioned or discussed, what happens is actually pretty well known to everybody, and that is that the conflict goes underground, where it will do more harm than good. I can take an example from the churches. As I've said, I'm a Quaker, I'm a Christian. Most organizational development people, I've done a lot of work in churches, and I've done a lot of work with folks who do what's called organizational development. They will tell you that churches are about the hardest organization to work with because they use their pious rhetoric, the thin veneer of a certain belief system, to mask the conflict that they feel, and to refuse to let it emerge where it might be dealt with, instead driving it underground where it eats away at the, as it were, at the root system of the tree in a very toxic manner. Most organizational development people that I know say, I'd much rather deal with a Fortune 500 company. And so conflict ignored is conflict that becomes even more toxic. It's very important to bring it out as, again, an energy for change, like anger. The framers of our Constitution, the founders of this country, they made a lot of bad mistakes. For them, we the people included a very narrow range of folks who, surprise, surprise, were exactly like them. They were white males, landed gentry. The we the people did not include Native Americans, it did not include enslaved human beings, it did not include women, and it did not include white people who did not own land. So that they planted some very toxic DNA in our system, which we're still struggling to work out and work through, and I suspect we will be for a very long time to come. It's animating, as I said earlier, a lot of our politics today. But they had the wisdom to create a tension-holding system that over the years has allowed us to correct some of their most grievous errors. And we have to thank them for that. And the best example I can give at the moment is that they gave us a system that over time has allowed us to greatly expand the notion of who belongs to we the people. So that today we the people includes all kinds of folks whom the founders would never have imagined would be part of this deal called America, and in some cases would not have approved. But I credit people with special genius when they create a system that allows other people to correct their own mistakes. So yes, we have to reframe conflict as something positive, something that rightly held has positive potential. We're not holding it well today. If we don't hold conflict well, we won't have a democracy, because a democracy is, by definition, a creative conflict-holding system.
You talked about correcting mistakes, and I wanted to ask you about, to switch gears and ask you a little bit about the notion of mentoring and why you disagree with older people who say that they mentor because they want to prevent young people from making the same mistakes that they did.
Well, I guess the first answer to that is it's impossible. Part of being young is to make the same mistakes we did so that you can figure things out for yourself, just like we had to do. There are all these questions of readiness in life, I think. When is one ready to take good advice? Well, one is ready when one is ready. But the best advice comes often from experimentation and hard experience, and it comes from within, up from within yourself. I know that adults like to give young people all kinds of well-intended advice, but I think that comes off to a lot of young people as very paternalistic, very much saying, you don't know what you're doing, so let me tell you what you're doing. There's another path, and that's the path of accompaniment. You walk with them. You invite them to reflect on good, honest, open questions. How do you feel about what you're doing at the moment? And if, you know, if there's some niggling doubt in there, where's that doubt coming from? And if you think you're totally right, where's that certainty coming from? There's all kinds of ways of asking honest, open questions to help younger people reflect more deeply on who they are and what they're doing and whether they're really following their own best lights. And I realize that's slow and, you know, may not prevent going over the cliff sometimes. But if a person's going to go over the cliff, they're going to go over the cliff. And I think, you know, a lot of parents have learned that you can't lock a teenager in his or her bedroom and expect to get good results out of that. But you can get some results, results that are within human reach and capacity, by being a guide on the side, as they say, by walking with them, by asking them honest, open questions, and above all, by listening deeply and respecting deeply this emerging life that's doing exactly what I had to do, and I would bet, Nyla, what you had to do too, to kind of grope your way through the thickets of life and, you know, find a path that works for you. I think about my dad, whom I loved very much, who was a Chicago businessman. He was a great teacher in that he gave very little advice and asked a lot of questions. And that ultimately led me down paths that were totally foreign to my father. And I'm sure that he spent a lot of time not understanding what I was doing. And in fact, wondered about the wisdom of it. But what he gave me was the great gift of having to think things out for myself and test things out for myself. But as long as I was at home, and even after that, being able to asking me good questions that drew me into reflection about what I was doing, and trusting me to come to a place where I belonged.
We're going to continue this conversation in just a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. And if you're just tuning in, we've been revisiting our conversation with Parker Palmer about his book that came out this year, On the Brink of Everything, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. Some of you folks might remember Parker's voice or name from On Being. I asked Parker about a series of open letters he wrote for On Being about men in their inner lives. Parker, do you think enough men are coming together in a way that women often do to share their hopes and fears and frustrations?
Men don't tend to get together as often, in my experience, with each other to talk vulnerably about their hopes and dreams. In the work I do, which is partly running retreats where people are invited under very safe circumstances to be vulnerable, we're lucky if we hit one-third men and two-thirds women. Often the percentage of men will be lower than that. I have three times in my life experienced profound clinical depression. And it's a devastating place to be where, I mean, there is no more isolated and lonesome place on earth than profound clinical depression. You feel absolutely cut off from other people. Lots and lots of men of my description, white, straight, middle class men, suffer from depression. One of the best books on male depression has a bang-on title. And that title is, I Don't Want to Talk About It. I have a deep devotion to really trying to change that dance. That's why I write and speak about my own depression. I think it's important for people who have not only survived depression, and especially men who have survived depression, but who found some way to thrive in the wake of depression, I think it's important for us to speak up and say, yeah, I have a mental illness along with my gifts and strengths, and I'm not ashamed of it. It's part of who I am. It's part of what has shaped me. We need to open up this conversation because depression afflicts not only millions of depressed individuals, but multiple millions of people who are trying to figure out how to accompany them in life, and that's a hard job. And so, you know, there's this notion of the wounded healer. When something that awful happens to you, there's only one thing to do with it, and that's, as you begin to emerge, to try to find meaning in it, with it, through it. And writing about it and sharing it with others is one of my ways of making meaning out of what would otherwise be an absolutely meaningless experience.
Do you think it also is a exercise in keeping your heart supple?
Absolutely. It's in some ways, depression falls somewhere between the little deaths I was talking about earlier and the big death that awaits all of us at the end of the road, because it is a living form of death. Depression is not just being lost in the dark. At its depths, depression is becoming the dark. And that's a terrible place to be, because when you're just lost in the dark, you can make a separation between yourself and the darkness. You can say, okay, I'm lost, but I can grope around in here and maybe find my way. But when you've become the dark, there is no separation between you and that deep, deep night. If you're unable to step back and look at it and try to figure out where to go next, as they say, your goose is cooked, at least for a while, and all you can do is hang on.
That was Parker Palmer talking about his book that came out this year, On the Brink of Everything, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. If you've ever been swimming in one of the Great Lakes here in the Midwest, you know they have all one thing in common, that's being icy cold, even on the warmer summer day in Chicago. The water's pretty refreshing, shall we say. Back in the fall, researchers at Purdue University released an impact assessment report and found that the Great Lakes are indeed warming. And although that might make for better swimming, higher temperatures could have a disastrous effect on Lake Michigan's game fish, like trout and salmon, which depend on cold water. It also could affect smaller inland lakes that have fragile ecosystems. For more on this, we were joined on the line by Paris Collingsworth. He's a research professor in the Department of Forestry and Natural Resources at Purdue University. He's also the Great Lakes Ecosystem Specialist for the Illinois-Indiana Sea Grant. Also on the line with us was Karen Murchie, a research biologist at the Shedd Aquarium. I started by asking Paris, how significant would it be if the Great Lakes were to warm by even 1 degree?
Right. So we have observations from Lake Michigan that have shown that the surface waters in the lake have been warming at about 1 degree Fahrenheit per decade. But this ends up translating into, you know, by mid-century, we're talking about water temperatures that are forecasted to increase by 5 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit. And you're right. You know, from a human perspective, that really doesn't sound like a lot of warming. But rising temperatures can have big effects on the ecosystems because of how they interact with certain components of the ecosystem. For example, increases in water temperatures could make Lake Michigan much more susceptible to invasion by invasive species. And that's just one of the things that we talk about in our impact assessment.
And when we're thinking particularly about colder water fish, like Lake Michigan's game fish, as we're thinking about, how would that affect the ecosystem?
Right. So many of the fish that people care about in Lake Michigan, you know, things like salmonids, like the Chinook salmon, the coho salmon, and the lake trout, they prefer, you know, colder water. So, you know, say approximately, you know, 50 degrees Fahrenheit. What will happen in this warmer and changing climate, it's going to push these fish further offshore. They're going to be able to find water that's at their preferred temperature, but they're going to have to go further offshore to do it. And what that can do is that can have pretty dramatic impacts on the fisheries of the lake. For example, if you're having to go further offshore, that's going to make your fishing trips much more expensive to get out further out into the lake. It could also even have large-scale effects where it's making different ports less productive from a fisheries perspective. So, say, for example, along the southern shoreline of Lake Michigan, it could be that charter fishermen are finding that they're having to go so far offshore that it would make more sense economically for them to move their boats out of the southern harbors and move them, you know, say, to Wisconsin, where they have deeper waters that are closer to the shoreline.
Mm. And Karen, apart from the fishing aspect of it, how will the warmer water actually affect these fish that like colder temperatures?
Well, I think this lake, really humans like different temperature ranges and in our houses too. We all have our preferences for what we like. The variety of different fish species have their temperature tolerances as well. And I realize that there is a lot of focus on the game species, but there's a lot of different species that are playing a supporting role to game fish as well. And I like to think it's worth mentioning all the different species that are in the lake that we should consider when talking about changing climate, because if any of the smaller bodied fish that are important as forage for game species, they're responding to changes in climate too. And they their populations can change also, that could end up having an effect. So I think that's just an important aspect for your listeners to be aware of as well,
mm-hmm.
that it's not just the game species that can be affected by the change in climate.
Right. To your point, Paris, I wonder, because you all looked at this, right? You looked at food webs. I know in your research, you look at smaller species like plankton and crayfish. We've been talking about warmer climates, but also what about wetter climates? What impact does more rain have on this food web?
The more, I guess, robust predictions about climate change is that we're going to see pretty dramatic changes in the hydrology. So it's not so much just that there's going to be, you know, more water or less water. It's that we are going to see changes in the amount of water, but also in the timing of, like, when that water is delivered into the system. One thing that does come up pretty frequently in the climate models is that we're going to have much wetter springs. And so springs are a really important time for nutrient delivery into the Great Lakes. So springs are, it's a time when a lot of farmers are typically putting fertilizer on their fields. And then if we have a lot of precipitation before, you know, the crops come up and can take up those nutrients essentially get washed off into the tributaries and ultimately make their way into the lakes. And so if we have really, you know, dramatic changes in the amount of water that's coming into the spring, we could see a lot more nutrients that are coming off of the watershed coming into the lake. That can be a good thing and a bad thing. In the middle of the lake, out in the open water, we tend to suffer from a lack of nutrients out there. But unfortunately, what happens a lot in Lake Michigan is we have really strong longshore currents that tend to take the nutrients and keep them in nearshore areas. We also have an invasive species called quagga mussels that are very abundant on the bottom of Lake Michigan, and they tend to be concentrated in nearshore areas, although they are expanding out into deeper waters. And they also tend to use up a lot of these nutrients, or essentially feed off the phytoplankton that's using these nutrients before they have an opportunity to make it out into the open lake and work their way into those food webs.
And Karen, what effect does that have? So to Paris's point about, for example, this invasive mussel species, what effect does that have on smaller fish and then up the food chain?
Well, as Paris was getting at, too, depending on where you're living in the lake and the nutrient runoff and who gets what and how that might affect the, you know, whether the increased precipitation bringing in nutrients, is that going to be a positive or potentially negative effect? But everything is really tied together. So depending on where, whether it's the invasive species, how they're distributed and what nutrients they take in terms of competing with other organisms for those resources, it just sort of plays into it, a numbers game, and in terms of who's where and how many and that kind of competition. So it does get to be a little bit more complex when you're trying to figure out the exact effects that are going to happen in certain locations. It has a lot to do with where the species are distributed. That's going to be based on the different physical attributes of that location, the temperature, the oxygen, the depth, and the amount of light that gets there. So I think that's kind of feeding off of what Paris was saying.
And Paris, is this clear that this is happening because of climate change, correct?
The changes in precipitation?
And temperature?
Yes, yeah, that's certainly what the climate models are forecasting.
And so I think there are probably some people who are listening who wonder what they can do about this. Is there anything?
Well, so one thing that we focus on in our assessment is essentially the lake managers. And that's, as Karen mentioned, these climate change effects are really quite complicated, and they involve interactions with a lot of the sort of current stressors that management agencies in the Great Lakes are dealing with, things like invasive species and nutrient deliveries. And so what we suggest is that the managers, they should stay focused on these short-term threats, but we need to have more research to understand how these threats interact with warmer temperatures and the changes in hydrology that may occur.
Paris Collingsworth is a research professor in the Department of Forestry and Natural Resources at Purdue University. Karen Murchie is a research biologist at the Shedd Aquarium. That does it for us today. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. It's a good way to find past shows. You download it, set your home station, and if you search for the 21st, that's the 21st, to follow us, you can easily listen to past shows that way. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, if you search for the 21st to like us, you can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All of those links and every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Vishesh Anand, Libby Foster, Robin Lin, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a Merry Christmas, and we'll see you back on Wednesday.